So I think that we could carry on with the session. And now I'd like to present Professor Miquel Martín Casals. I think that perhaps he needs no presentation, actually, because he's very well known by most of us. But anyway, let me present him very briefly. Professor Miquel Martín Casals is the director of the Institute of European and Comparative Private Law of the University of Girona. And he's a member of several groups, research groups and institutions, both in Spain and internationally, such as the European Group on Tort Law, the Commission on European Family Law, and the European Center of Tort and Insurance Law in Vienna. He's also a deputy president of the International Society of Family Law and a member and the president of the Group of Studies on Legal Drafting. And moreover, he's a member of the American Law Institute. He has published extensively in the field of tort law, and he's going to present a paper on proportional liability in Spain, a bridge too far. Professor Martin, you have the floor.
Thank you, Albert. Thank you. When I was trying to write this working paper, because it's only a working paper, I had in mind a meeting that we had here three years ago, with seven judges of the Spanish Supreme Court, 7 out of 10, sitting on the front row, and my dearest colleague and friend, Jaap Speer, trying to explain them how wonderful proportional liability was, you know? So I felt so sorry for Jaap, because the Supreme Court judges did not buy it, you know? And, I have been thinking all these years why they did not buy the thing, you know? Of course, when I talk about proportional liability, it's well known that proportional liability can be used in a broader sense, referred as the general idea of apportioning harm and its consequences between different subjects. This is the case, for instance, when multiple tortfeasors are solidarily liable and the one who has paid damages seeks contribution from the others, or when apportionment is done between one or several defendants and one or several claimants on the grounds of the so-called contributory negligence in Europe or comparative negligence in the United States. In this paper, however, proportional liability is used in a narrower sense to refer in cases of uncertain factual causation, and this is the guiding line, to a doctrine that stands for the attribution of responsibility for the harm to the defendant according to the probability that the tortious conduct or activity was a factual cause of the harm, by contrast to the all or nothing rule traditionally used by courts, at least in Spain. As is well known, the all or nothing rule establishes that either the defendant caused the damage or he did not, and provides that when a standard of proof of causation is met, the claimant obtains compensation for the full amount of his damage, even if there remains a possibility that the defendant did not cause it. Conversely, when the standard of proof of causation is not met, even when there is a high probability that the defendant caused the harm, but this probability remains below the required standard of proof, the claimant obtains no compensation at all. You know? So far, the situation. It is also well known that the combination of the all-or-nothing rule with a standard of proof based on the balance of probabilities, more probable than not, can give sometimes impression that deciding whether to compensate victims is something as random as tossing a coin. Thus, it has been affirmed that if it's shown that there is just 49% probability that the defendant caused the damage, the defendant will have to compensate nothing, whereas if it's shown that there is a 51% probability, he will have to compensate the whole amount of the damage suffered by the claimant. It can be said then that no liability is unfair, since it lets the tortfeasor escape scot-free just for a small percentage of probability, and that the system underdeters wrongdoers. Conversely, full liability is also unfair, since it holds the defendant liable for an amount of damage that he may not have caused and leads to over-deterrence. The award is not discounted at the causation stage for the possibility that the part of the loss might have been caused by another factor. Since the all-or-nothing rule admits the possible commission of an error each time it grants or refuses compensation, it is contended that the proportional liability rule seems superior And it's sometimes suggested that the all or nothing rule should be abandoned in favor of compensation of damage according to the proportion of its factual causation. Well, this is more or less what Yap tried to explain. And of course, the faces of the judges, you know, were, you know, looking in a funny way more and more and more. Why? The first thing is because the notion of proportional liability is still unknown in the practice of Spanish courts. In legal scholarship, only a few authors, normally in the wake of foreign law, refer to proportional liability as part of the doctrinal debate on problems of causal uncertainty. In particular, there are references to proportional liability in the context of the proof of causation in the area of damage caused by defective products and unavoidable damage and with regard to medical liability. I think, however, a legal doctrine such as proportional liability is not a commodity that can be produced in one country and be sold in any other country worldwide. It requires an adequate legal climate in order to be able to grow and prosper, and one has to bear in mind that legal transplants can not only become legal irritants, but can also become a source of endless confusion and headache. In order to avoid this, it's very important to be well aware of the cultural and institutional setting of the legal system where a doctrine is going to be introduced, and I'm going to give just a broad approach to the Spanish tort law system. And regard the general aspects of a Spanish tort law system, the first thing that one has to bear in mind is that in Spain, tort law cases can be decided by civil courts, criminal courts, administrative courts, and labor courts. But the difference does not stop here. Civil courts decide according to the civil code and a specific civil act. Criminal courts according to the provisions of the criminal code and a specific corresponding acts. And administrative and labor courts also decide pursuant to their own sectoral rules. The legal diversity, this legal diversity, however, may be counterbalanced by the fact that provisions dealing with tort law in the codes are scant, and rules included in specific acts cannot be generally applied to other situations that have not been foreseen in these specific acts. For all these reasons, judicial discretion has traditionally been wider in the area of tort law than in other private law areas. The use of case law in the area of tort law is much more important than in our or other areas of our continental legal systems, and the solution given by every single court can be more dynamic over time. Additionally, what should bear in mind that Spanish legal scholarship has paid hardly any attention to tort law until 1980s. The first handbook on tort law is from 1940. The first treatise from the year 2002. And until recently, tort law has been just one or two lessons in a syllabus of a student. In the law of obligations, just one or two lessons in a program in the syllabus of law of obligations. As regards causation, until the first years of this millennium, Spanish legal doctrine devoted very little attention to the problems related to the topic when dealing with tort law. Following the French, following what the French had understood about the German tradition, Spaniards followed the French, and actually they contrasted the older theory of the equivalence of conditions, bad for test, conditio sine qua non, with what it was claimed to be a new theory of adequate causation, which was also understood as a sort of factual causation. So traditionally, there was no strict divide between factual causation or causation as such and legal causation, or what we would call nowadays a scope of liability, a distinction which is it was introduced in Spain for the first time in 1990 as an Anglo-German import, but which has not been embraced by the Supreme Court until the first years of this century. Since the beginning of the century, the Spanish Supreme Court has been confronted with the distinction, but it has been busier with scope liability problems than with problems of factual causation. By contrast, it has been paid very little attention has been paid to causation, in fact, and other areas have kept the courts busy. Another important part to look at of the Spanish setting are the basic rules of evidence. I am not an expert in evidence in Spain, so, but probably no one is, because evidence is something which is not studied properly in Spain, except by some of colleagues. But the position in Spain with regard to the proof of causation, by contrast to the proof of fault, has been very strict. In the area of fault, until recently, fault was presumed in most cases. You know, this is something we had in common with our colleagues of the former Iron Curtain. You know, so the Czechs and the Polish and all that, I discovered that in the meeting, had done that for many years. I don't know why in Spain we did it, but for many years, fault was almost always presumed, and the defendant had to rebut the presumption of fault. But in the case of causation it was not the case, so the courts were very strict with causation. However, the new Civil Procedural Act, passed in the year 2000, so 12 years ago, has clarified the situation and has introduced some rules that may alleviate the claimant's problems as regards proof. As regards the burden, what probably you would call the burden of production, the Civil Procedural Act 2000 provides that the claimant must prove the facts upon which he establishes the ground of his claim, whereas the defendant must prove those that exclude them. These and other rules established in this provision, it says one of these provisions, shall apply whenever there is no specific provision that distributes the burden of proving the relevant facts with a specific criterion. While this excludes something that was very often done in the past, this excludes the possibility for the courts to reverse the burden of proof, to reverse the evidentiary burden of proof or burden of production, the last paragraph of this provision establishes that in applying the provisions of the preceding paragraph of these articles, the court shall consider what it calls the availability and ease of evidence corresponding to each of the parties to the dispute. In the tort area, this means probably that while the burden of production lies initially upon the claimant who has to establish his cause of action, and the need for predictability in the litigation process requires the burden of production to be allocated by rules of law and not to the, by the discretion of the judges, there are cases in which the means of proving the specific facts as to the cause of harm are peculiarly within the power of the defendant. For this reason, the explanation should come from him rather from the claimant, who may not be able to prove the relevant facts. Accordingly, whenever it appears that the defendant has in his power the possibility to produce substantial evidence material to the issue, but fails to do so, it must be presumed that such evidence, if produced, would have been adverse to the defendant. If under such circumstances the available evidence is insufficient to support a decision for the defendant, the lack of production of this evidence gives rise to decision in favor of the claimant. So this easier availability and access to information rule introduces into Spanish law a new rule of evidence which has clear consequences as regards to liability. If evidence is not available and the defendant is responsible for the non-availability of evidence, the defendant is liable. Finally, to finish with this procedural or evidence part, the proof of causation can also be carried out through presumptions which allowed the indirect demonstration of unknown facts with the assistance of inferences drawn from the facts that are in evidence before the court. And so Spanish courts talk about legal presumptions, those established by statute, and factual presumptions, which are those at the discretionary power of the judges. As regards the standard of proof, the degree to which the proof must be established by the party on which the legal burden of proof rests, a Spanish law, for no surprise, we have been talking about this morning as regards to other continental countries, requires a very high standard of proof. Thus, courts hold that although there is no need for absolute certainty, causation must be proved with reasonable certainty and no lower the standards as the more probable than not are accepted. Legal doctrine also contends that the standard of certainty is equivalent to high probability levels based on what corresponds to the regular or normal course of events. And by contrast to the balance of probabilities, it considers that holding a fact more probable than not is not enough, is not sufficient. However, Spanish courts never argue in terms of probability. One of the reasons our Supreme Court judges, they were so shocked, you know, when we're talking about 49%, 51%. But since common law scholarship more often than not refers to these percentages, some Spanish authors, to be able to talk with them, try to venture which percentage would correspond to our standard. Thus, in order to compare with this 50-plus common law rule, these authors consider that the probability that would be necessary to establish a reasonable certainty standard required in Spain should be placed above 80%. Just for the argument's sake, it's interesting to continue this comparison of the more probable than not with this, I insist, fictitious and hypothetical standard of 80-plus standard, in order to see that the idea of proportional liability, that is, the liability in proportion to the probability of causation, is not so straightforward for Spanish judges or lawyers, and not so compelling, the virtues are not so compelling when we have such an standard. So in this case, 80% plus, in spite of the same difference of one unit up and down, the fact that the dividing line is not placed in the middle of the scale makes that affirming or rejecting liability on the grounds of the existence or non-existence of factual causation does not seem such an arbitrary issue. And what is more important, accepting proportional liability means an important increase on the situations where defendants, albeit only for the corresponding proportion, will be held liable. So from 80%, to 1%, so there are 79 points of margin, you know. And if proportional liability, so to say, cuts both ways, so the other margin is very narrow, you know, it's very small. If we leave the ideal world of mathematics and come back to the real practice, proportional liability may hardly have any practical effect in the upper limit and a very strong effect in the lower one in a system like ours. In any case, the asymmetry existing in a system not based on the balance of probabilities distorts some, I would say even many, aspects of the reasoning that have been put forward in favor of proportional liability in those countries where their standard of proof is based on the balance of probabilities. Proportional liability in Spain. We are talking about mass torts, and sometimes we have forgotten that. I must say something about mass torts in Spain, which have nothing to do with causation, but I'll have something about that. In the area of liability for defective products, legal scholars usually refer to market share liability in Spain as an attempt to cope with uncertainty occurring when trying to identify which defendant caused which harm to the claimant. In the area of liability for the environment, they talk about pollution share liability, holding thereby or pretending or proposing that the firms creating pollution sources should be held liable in proportion to their share of emissions of pollution. And in other areas, in areas of medical liability, they are also in favor of establishing proportional liability instead of using this covert device of the loss of chance that we're going to see at the end. However, in the practice courts, although they might start thinking about the issue, and in some areas there is a small debate starting mainly in the area of healthcare liability and medical law, proportional liability seems to be totally absent in the area of mass torts. Probably you know that the most famous case, the mass tort case in Spain, was the rape oil or colza oil case. This case dealt with fatal poisoning of several hundred victims and the serious diseases caused to several thousand victims who had bought and used colza oil as foodstuff. After many years of litigation, the total damages award was over 3,000 million euros, which today is still this award, the highest award ever paid in compensation. And in this case, it was the state who had to pay a subsidiary liable for a crime committed by one of its employees. In this case, causation was only a peripheral issue, although scientific experts could never explain from a chemical or from a biological point of view how the disease came about, which were the ingredients, the factors that triggered the disease. They could relate the ingestion of this oil with the production of disease to the required level of certainty. For this reason, some Yama scholars have contended that this was a case where the Spanish courts used the more probable than not standard, the common law standard. This is not, I don't think this is correct. What I think is that the problem of causation, it was another one, which it was solved with comparative law, in this case with the German case, and in this case it was held that the Supreme Court held that causation could be established even when the particular substance that caused the damage was unknown, whenever there was evidence proving the connection between the product and the damage, and any other factor could be excluded as cause of the damage. So it was known that it was a substance, ingestion of substance that caused the damage. It was not known why, but it was always seen the relation, and it could be excluded that there were other situations. Another area internationally very important, in, as we all know, in the area of causation problems is asbestos litigation. Asbestos litigation is not unknown in Spain. From January 1996 to January 2010, there had been at least 190 decisions on damage caused by asbestos in Spain. Compensation for each victim has been so far rather low, so ranging from 6,000 euros to up to €500,000 in a mesothelioma case. However, the number of cases and the importance of the awards is increasing. Compensation has been awarded not only to occupational victims, but also to what we would call second wave victims, like, for instance, family members exposed through clothing of the workers, and children and citizens exposed to asbestos dumped in playgrounds or as cheap pavements in some streets in small villages. Compensation has been awarded for mesothelioma, asbestosis, and cancer, and with no hesitation whatsoever for pleural plaques as well. Asbestos litigation, which has obtained important verdicts in favor of the victims most recently, just a few weeks ago, will unfortunately increase over the next years, since according to an estimate of one of the main Spanish trade unions, Comisiones Obreras, the number of asbestos fatal victims between the year 2000 and the year 2030 will be around 50,000. However, so far, causation has not been perceived as a crucial problem in litigation. Experts consider that it is possible that when asbestos litigation increases and when the legal discussion becomes more sophisticated, causation problems similar to those that have appeared in other jurisdictions may also be debated in Spain. For now, in most cases, damage has been the result of the exposure created by one single company, and in the few cases where the victim has been exposed to more than one source, causation has not been considered as a problem, or has been, depending on the opinion, not properly solved. So this is a case decided by the Superior Court of Murcia. There was a claimant P, who was the widower of the worker, who had died as a result of a mesothelioma. And the mesothelioma was caused by the exposure to asbestos dust over time. And during the working life, this worker had worked for 5 months with one company, 7 months for another, 1 month for another, and 20 years for another company who was in charge of doing something for a further company, so five companies. So the widow brought an action against all the five companies, and the court disregarded the first three, considering that the exposure in just 13 months was not important enough when compared to the exposure of the last two workers that was over 20 years, you know. And in this case, held the companies D4 and D5 as solidarily liable. Well, solidarity is not a problem here, since D5 was vicariously liable, and solidarity results from vicarious liability in this case. But for the rest of the decision, the deletion would be at least arguable, under my point of view, because although the risk of contracting mesothelioma may be linked to the length of the exposure to asbestos, and it's not very well known how the mechanism of mesothelioma works, it's probable, it seems, that once the fiber or fibers causing mesothelioma have been inhaled, further exposure is irrelevant. So, in this case, it could have been also possible that these fatal or several fatal fibers had been inhaled during the short time of exposure with the first defendants. So, I think that in this case, probably it was not the best result, but at least the Superior Court of Murcia saw no problem there. Well, now let's see in which areas do the causation problems arise. Well, I'm not going to talk about hunters, I'm not going to talk about cows, but we have similar problem in cases of indeterminate defendant, cases of alternative liability, and my question is, alternative liability a case of proportional liability? Well, because there are some people that say that the way we solve it in Spain, some young scholars say that this is the new trend of proportional liability. Case referred here as alternative liability are known in Spain as damage caused by an indeterminate member of a group, or cases of alternative multiple tortfeasors. Here it is known for certain that the damage has been caused by one of the actors involved, or by several of them, but isn't known which one, in terms of conditio sine qua non, which one was actually being the cause of the harm. As in other countries, the examples given in Spain refer to members of hunting party, as well cases of harm suffered by children while playing and arguing with other children, etc., etc. By contrast to other legal systems, like the German Civil Code or the Dutch Civil Code, there is no general provision in the Spanish Civil Code providing for a solution of the problem. However, Spanish case law and the prevailing legal scholarship considers that in these cases of multiple tortfeasor, solidarity applies, solidarity liability applies. To tortfeasors who have acted in concert, such as co-authors, person under, acting under previous agreement, there is no doubt that solidarity liability applies because the Penal Civil Code expressly provides so. The Penal Civil Code deals also with the civil consequences when the act was a crime or a misdemeanor, a big crime or a smaller crime, you know, so we solve according to the civil rules of the Penal Code. But what happened to members of the group who did not act in concert? In this case, the doctrine has looked around and in order to be happy that they are not doing anything against the sacred rule of causation, and they say, well, in this case, there was a collective dangerous activity, and although the causation link cannot be established with a single defendant, it can be established with a group. So the whole world is in calm, you know, and no problem arises. As well, in order for the judges to be happy with the solution, they say that in these cases, there are many acts, many articles and different acts in Spain that provide for dissolution. Actually, one of the arguments was that there is the Hunting Act, and the Hunting Act establishes solidarity liability. You know? So the decisions of the Spanish Supreme Court normally solve this problem with the problem of with the solution of solidarity liability in these cases. Young scholars have held, and I think they have rightly held, that holding all members of the group solidarity liable when the claimant has not been able to identify which of them was a cause of the harm means a departure of the traditional rules on factual causation. In a way, and in a way that is sometimes confusing to me, this younger scholarship compare this doctrine with other doctrines as comparative negligence, intervention of a third party, concurring force majeure, and say that in these cases of solidarity liability, there are cases of proportional liability, but in the internal relation. Well, to me, this is not a correct way of explaining, because I think that solidary liability and proportional liability exclude each other, you know? So, in my opinion, what happens in these cases is that first, there is a problem with the rule of evidence, and then there is a problem with, a substantial rule, whatever it means, substantial, because probably it means something different for you than for us, you know? So first, the rule of evidence provides that uncertainty regarding who caused the harm among several possible tortfeasors must be solved in favor of the victim. An innocent victim is preferred over a tortfeasor who may not have caused the harm, but who was at fault or was engaged in a dangerous activity subject to strict liability. And then this rule of evidence shifts the burden of proof to the defendants. Any defendant who is able to meet the burden of proof will exclude himself or herself from possible liability. And then if finally there are two or more defendants who have not been able to do so, the judge must move to a second step. Many reasons, of course, speak in favor of this first step regarding the rule of evidence, as we have said, preference of innocent victims, risk control, minimization of the risk of error, and so forth, you know. But then, once you have overcome this first step, and we have still two or more defendants left who have not been able to exclude themselves, then we must go into the second step in establishing whether this liability is solidary, I mean jointly and several, or just proportional or several. But these are two different steps. The first step is to establish, well, in this case, in spite that we don't meet the burden of proof for causation, can we establish that there was causation? And then in the second step, we have to decide between joint and several liability or proportional liability. Whereas in the first step, the issue was the distribution of the evidentiary risk, in the second step, the issue is the distribution of the insolvency risk, as well as the risk that one or several potential tortfeasors cannot be traced and brought to the court. If one of them is insolvent, as long as a single solvent remains, the victim will obtain compensation in full if we adopt the solidary liability rule. By contrast, partial of several liability places the risk that any of the possible defendants has disappeared or has become insolvent upon the victim. Whereas most countries accept the solidary liability rule, proportional liability is also possible, as, for instance, the European principles of tort law propose. And actually, that was what Yap was trying to explain to the judges of the Supreme Court, to say, well, if you have, let us say, used the evidentiary rules in favor of the victim, don't place everything in favor of the victim, place something also against the victim, in the sense that you should not hold defendants that have not caused the harm also liable in full for all the defendants. According to the pro-victim traditional approach of Spanish law, and this is very important, you know, tut por la victim is something that can also be said in Spanish, you know. We follow a pro-victim traditional approach. Proportional liability seems difficult to accept. That's what the judges of the Supreme Court said. Moreover, once the factual causation hurdle is overcome, with the above-mentioned first step of rules of evidence, for a Spanish judge, then seems difficult to accept why he should depart from the position of holding all defendants solidarily liable, which is the rule generally applied in the cases of multiple tortfeasors case. So the judges don't understand, well, now we have no problem with causation, why should we depart from the traditional rule, which is when once causation is established and there are multiple defendants, let's hold them all solidarily liable. However, according to the new Civil Procedure Act, what it can be put now into question is the first step. The first step dealing with the reversal of the burden of proof, it can be put into question because we don't have any provision in the civil code that establishes this reversal of burden of proof, and the new procedural act says that there must be a specific provision establishing reversal of proof for a specific case. So in this case, if we were going to be strict as regards the rules of procedure, we would say that the rules of procedure do not allow any longer to say that since there are several acts that provide for solidarity liability, in the general rule is that there is solidarity liability because there is no general rule establishing solidarity liability. However, it is also possible that what is happening now with the rules of evidence, that the Supreme Court, what it does, it uses this easier availability and access of information to overcome the problem posed with not being able to dispose with the reversal of the burden of proof. And probably in this case, it could say that difficulties of proof could come should come to the detriment of those who created them. Something we were talking yesterday, you know, about, well, if it had not been true, my proof would have been easier, so you introduce uncertainty, so if this uncertainty should be against you. But this, it should be a way that has not, a way out that has not been found by the courts, because they have not noticed yet that they cannot reverse the burden of proof in these situations. Just to finish, let's talk about the loss of chance. Spanish law acknowledges the doctrine of the loss of chance in two main groups of cases. The first group is claims against physicians and hospitals for the loss of the chance to heal or to survive. And the second one is the claims against lawyers for the so-called procedural chances, loss of procedural chances, that is, the chances to win a case. In both cases, the introduction of loss of chance doctrine is quite recent. In the field of healthcare liability, the Spanish Supreme Court received this doctrine of loss of chance in 1998. It was a case that a man who was a worker in a ice cream company, he had an accident and a machine cut one of his hands, you know. So everybody in the factory, you know, pick up the hand. The hand called an ambulance, a doctor came, and the doctor said, well, preserve this hand properly, you know. So they were such a good friends of the person who had suffered the harm that they wanted to do their best, and they put the hand inside of a cake, tartar, you know, and they preserved it with ice, which was not natural ice, was synthetic ice, you know. So the point is that the doctor did not pay any attention to how the hand was preserved, and when the hand, together with the patient, arrived at the hospital, the hand could not be reimplanted because the preservation wasn't proper. Had it been preserved with normal natural ice, it could have had the chance at 20%, 25% of reimplanting, but since synthetic ice was used, then there was not possible. Now, so in this case and in another case, at the beginning, the courts started talking about a loss of chance, and the loss of chance was a non-pecuniary loss. So in this case, it was a non-pecuniary loss. It was not a problem of causation. It was a problem of certain chance, and this chance was what we call a daño moral, a non-pecuniary loss, and not a link between a certain proportion could be established. However, in later decisions, that link could be established. In a decision of a diver who was diving close to Valencia, and he went too deep and up too quick, and when he went up too quick, he had a dysbaric problem. And he needed an hyperbaric chamber. There was no hyperbaric chamber there. The closest one was in Barcelona. And the health company, it was the state social security, had to decide whether to take this person to Barcelona by a special helicopter or with an ambulance, you know. They thought that an ambulance would be enough, it was much cheaper, whatever, you know. So they took the man in ambulance, they got there 30 hours too late, you know, and this person suffered serious injuries, you know. So in this case, it was established that had he been treated properly, there was about 71.5 chances of recovery. He would have been able to be among those 71.5% of people who would have recovered and not suffered such a damage. In this case, the court did not talk about specific percentages, but awarded an amount which was more substantial than in other cases, and it was clear that we were in the direction of seeing that a loss of chance is not just a non-pecuniary loss, but is also pecuniary loss. The case that procedural chances, the so-called procedural chances for the lawyers that don't meet a deadline or whatsoever, and therefore they lost the opportunity of suing in benefit of their clients, at the beginning was thought also to be non-pecuniary loss, a pure non-pecuniary loss. And it was thought to be an infringement of the right access, the right of access to justice, according to the Constitution. I don't know why they came to this idea, because the right of access to justice, to me, is something that applies only to the public system, not to the private individuals, you know. But, well, it's more complicated because the Constitution, following some rules also applied in other countries, applies directly to the individuals in Spain sometimes. Well, in this case, at the beginning, was this idea, you know. But then, all of a sudden, the Supreme Court made a change and said, no, in this case, they're not just non-pecuniary losses, there are also pecuniary losses, you know? And in this case, we should see which were the chances of winning the case, and experts analyze this, experts, the judges and some other people, not a very complicated process, and they awarded something in proportion. To be honest, you know, these proportions are never made in an accurate way. In an accurate way, you know, they are more or less, you know, more or less they say, well, it's 70% and they compensate. But the trend, if we analyze that according to other criteria, and in fact, there is no proportional compensation, although they start talking about proportional liability, is a more or less compensation that helps to solve the problem. The loss of shine doctrine is, I think, very dangerous, because it's like a monster that can expand, you know. It helps you to be happy with your system, because you say, well, I must do something here. I cannot touch causation. So what I do is I say, well, this chance is a damage in itself, so I make it a damage, and, you know, and the world is in perfect order, causation stays there, you know. But what happens if you keep on doing all the time? If you keep on doing all the time, it may happen to what is happening now, very recent decision from the January this year. And in this case was dealing with a patient who suffered tetraplegia after undergoing a surgical operation and who had not been properly informed of the risk that the operation entailed. The Supreme Court held here that since no medical negligence in the performance of the operation occurred, the physician did not have to compensate for the resulting injury. However, according to the court, causation had to be established between the omission of information and the possibility of having avoided undergoing the medical intervention. So the decision considered that the lack of informed consent has led to a loss of chance for the patient not to undergo the operation, and that this loss of chance must be assessed according to the probability to which, if properly informed of this typical risk, the patient would have decided not to undergo the operation. What is very striking to me is that the court reserved this doctrine for what is called elective medicine, and says that this doctrine does not apply to what we would call, in Spanish, healing medicine, that is, cases where the medical intervention is necessary in order to prevent, to preserve the patient's health, by contrast to cases of elective medicine, where the patient undergoes intervention aiming at achieving a successful transformation of his body, as would be, for instance, cases of plastic surgery. This case was a case of elective medicine, you know, and since it was a case of elective medicine, it was applied. But I don't understand this theory, because even in the case of healing medicine, there is a choice, you know. I mean, in this case, in my opinion, this doctrine is absurd, since it knows that the patient may think that one bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. You know, so it's much better, you know, to say, well, you have only a few years of life, but at least you have four or five. But if you undergo an operation, you may have 10 years of life, but you have a 90% risk of not being able to wake up, you know. So in this case, I don't know whether I should be allowed to decide or not, you know, because it also has a value, you know. So I don't think that this doctrine is there and is for the the professor of university and the researchers to fight against it, I think, you know. In the case at the stake, the result reached by the court does not bring a big surprise. After having taken into account all the circumstances of the case, the court held that the probability that if properly informed the patient would have not undergone the operation was 50%, so damages was reduced to 50%. Well, if the Supreme Court is coherent, what it's going to do now is going to reduce all cases of elective medicine by 50%. And we'll have to come back to a theory that it was well established in the case of wrongful birth. In the case of wrongful birth, the first cases, there was about what the pregnant mother would have done had she known that the baby had terrible problems, you know. Some of the first decisions say, well, it's for the mother to prove that. And I remember some of us were working very hard, you know, to helping these mothers, you know, and said, well, in this case, it should be the physician who should show that even if he had acted with due care, because he was negligent, the result would have been the same, you know? And so the Supreme Court changed the position. So the position now was that in these cases, it's for the physician to prove that if he had been diligent, if he had informed the mother, and this is not a problem of informed consent, it's a therapeutic information, you know, but anyway, it's a problem of information. If he had informed the mother properly, the mother would have decided not to abort. So now the Supreme Court will have to see how they cope with these things. I think that the doctrine of loss of chance is dangerous because it can expand too much, and at least one of the ways to limit it is that the idea that the materialization of the favorable event or the avoidance of the harm or the injury must be random, must be something random, must not something dependent on the will of the defendant or of the plaintiff. Because if not, what we are going to do, we are going to be able to use loss of chance to solve all evidential problems, you know? And so when we have evidential problems, we will look at the probability, and according to the probability, we will compensate accordingly. I think that much more must be done in the area of proportional liability in Spain, but also much more must be done in the area of rules of evidence. So probably someday we'll meet in the middle of the point, and the bridge will not be too far. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Miquel Martín. So now we can start a debate. Professor Stapleton, please.
Thanks, Miguel. Could I take you just to the last few cases you were talking about, the loss of chance cases in the medical situation? I absolutely agree with you about this concept of the distinction between non-elective and healing medicine. You might like to know there's a House of Lords case where the you again, failure to warn, and the doctor argued that it was non-elective because this woman was having a baby, and if they didn't give her a cesarean section, she would die. So she refused, she was a nurse. So they sectioned her under the Mental Health Act, forced her to have a cesarean. She then sued for that invasion, and the House of Lords says there's no such thing as non-elective surgery. Even to save your life, you have, and I can give you the citation for that. What I didn't quite understand in that case was you said that they came up with this 50%. Was that because they barred self-serving testimony by the patient? Because presumably a patient could come in, and this is the problem we have in our systems, that patients always after the event will say, or unless they're honest like they were in the House of Lords case, Chester and Afshar, they will say, oh, well, if I'd been warned, of course I wouldn't have had this operation. So how did they get to the 50%? Was it that that's what she testified, or they just barred the testimony and made that assumption?
From the decision, it's not clear how they came to the 50%, uh-huh. You know? Because I think the 50% was that, according to those circumstances in the case, they could not say whether would have accepted or not. So in this case, so they split the difference. That I think that is ridiculous, because this is going to happen in most cases, you know? So in most cases, it's going to, and unless you force patients to produce a sort of declaration that saying, well, in case For instance, in the case of wrongful birth, you know, in the case I see that my child has a problem, then I am ready to undergo an abortion. But anyway, this is very difficult to produce, you know. This is still very difficult to produce. So in this case, it was not serious to say, because I think that this is a device that at the end what it's going to do is to halve compensation. And actually, all the argumentation was brought by the insurance company, and they had been studying for weeks in France, you know. They had been studying what the newest doctrine of the expansion of law of chance, just to try to introduce it here, you know. Mm-hmm. And in this case, I think that inadvertently the judge introduced this doctrine in this area, which is very new, and the result is 50% not based on really evidence. Specific facts.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. So I might just mention that in at least one Australian state, there is by statute a rule against the patient mm-hmm. testifying because the fear is that it will be self-serving. Mm-hmm. That rule doesn't exist in the United Kingdom, and the main case that went to the House of Lords, the testimony of the woman was, had she been warned about the risk of the operation, she wouldn't have had it on the day she had it, but she might have had it the next day. Mm-hmm. Now that, if you then say, well, what's the likelihood it would have happened then, mm-hmm. then the breach did actually cause her outcome, because you have to guess what would have happened on the Tuesday, and since it was random, mm-hmm. like lightning striking, more likely than not it wouldn't have happened. Mm-hmm. But this has caused a lot of problems in our system because mm-hmm. people don't quite understand that. Mm-hmm. But I think you're right, in your case, a lot of it comes back to your rules of evidence. Mm-hmm. So unless you have those clarified, it's going to be very difficult to see the outcome of these doctrines.
Yes, Professor Wright, and then Professor Rosenkranz.
Yes, in most of the familiar lost chance sort of cases, it's a case where there wasn't a diagnosis, there was a delay in treatment, and there was a certain arrived at however percentage of what probability would the results have been different if they had diagnosed in time or they had given a certain treatment. But in these cases of involving informed consent court cases, you have sort of a double probability problem, right? You have kind of a question of, you know, if informed, would they have decided differently in terms of taking the operation? And then if they, you know, then what would the probability be of something happening given if they had decided to have it or not? So is there a double probability problem here? I know that, I think, you know, from what Jane was talking about, we allow them to testify in the U.S., but we usually kind of say it's going to be an objective standard of what the reasonable person would have decided in the case, which pretty much takes it away from the patient. But some states like Oregon say it's subjective. You have to kind of sort of really take seriously what they said. But you have a double probability here, don't you? You have sort of one probability of would they have had the operation, and then if they would have had the operation, what would the result have been? Or am I missing something here?
Mm-hmm. No, well, in this case, this doctrine is new, and this is the first decision, I mean, in Spanish law. And this doctrine, what would say is that the probability you establish it between what the patient would have done, you know, and the result, you know. So, but it says only that, you know. So probably you are right that there is something there because it's the probability of the result. Yeah, there is not a probability that is not taken into account. Right.
I'm sort of curious about why you think that the loss of chance doctrine is problematic in the same way that. The cases of alternative causation, because it seems to me that in the loss of chance cases, the victim lost something. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about that. The question is what the victim lost, mm-hmm. right? So it's a question more amicable to be treated. It's a question of damages, and as a question of damages, it's much more easier to correlate it with likelihood, now, to discount the damage by the likelihood of it. So it's not problematic in the same way in which causation cases are problematic, because in the causation cases, you don't know if the defendant actually caused any harm. So it's a completely different kind of problem. It seems to me that, again, correlating damages with likelihood, with chances, is easier. And then going back to the case, to the asbestos case, I mean, it's interesting that the court was not moved by the fact that the victim was subject to much more longer times of exposure by the longer employer. It's curious, but it seems to me that it's the right decision somehow because you know, I would say, well, every employer the victim had did something that was equally efficacious to bring the harm about. So, you know, if we're going to presume that that the plaintiffs caused the harm, we had to presume for all of them equally. And that's what I was trying to defend yesterday somehow, that if you presume that the defendants did something that was able to cause the harm, it's fair to them to presume equally, independently on whether, for instance, one shot 10 shots or just one shot, mm-hmm. or one took, exposed the victim 1 month or 10 years.
Let me start by the second question, you know. I think that in this case, whether it must be equal or not, it depends on the etiology of the disease, you know. If it's a disease that it's done by accumulation, as
assuming
would be
that
asbestos.
That's the case. Assuming that that's the case. It's not by accumulation.
Well, if it's not according to accumulation and it can rise at any moment, then it should be probably assessed equally, regardless of the time of exposure, unless you could prove that a very short time of exposure was irrelevant. You know,
so statistics are not relevant there. That's
right. Yeah, well, that's it, because you can get the fibers in just 1 day, 3 days, 4 days. You know, so this is why I think that I don't know whether it's wrong or not, but I would say probably that it was not the best solution to the case. With regard to the other one, I mean, the other one in the case of a loss of chance. It can be also a problem of causation, and to me it's more a problem of causation, because it's something that is in your sphere of risk or not, you know? So in this case, there are many things in your life, in our lives, that in our sphere of risk, you know? And what it has happened here in this case is that there is a person who has increased the risk. You know, the other risks were in your sphere. You know, the 70% risk that you don't cope with an operation, if it's properly performed and all that, is in your sphere of risk. If the probability is reduced from 70 to 20%, then this difference is the seen from a long angle of point is an increase of risk, and that would could speak in favor of apportioning. Yes, well, the point is, you come with an ontological theory that you say that this is something that it's in the patrimony, let's put it this way, of the victim, you know? This victim has lost something, but we don't know whether this victim has lost something or not,
you know? She lost the chance to decide?
Well, because probably chance is not a problem of damage, it's a problem of causation.
Yes, Professor Borghetti and then Professor Wright.
Just to comment on this issue of loss of chance when the victim was not informed, we have the same solution in France, and which is debated. But the result is also in many cases, actually, that the judge says, well, even if you had been informed, you would have undertaken surgery because anyway it was... I mean, the expected benefits were much more important than the expected risks. So in the end, the victim gets nothing. And so a new solution that has popped up about 2 or 3 years ago is that the courts have said in some case, well, the Cour de Cassation said in at least one case, okay, you would have undertaken surgery in any case, but your right to an informed consent has been violated. So you deserve damages for that. So a kind of, you could say maybe actionable per se, the fact that your informed consent was violated. But then the Cour de Cassation, and that's the problem, doesn't have to say how you calculate those damages. So the question is, what is worth the violation of your right to informed consent? And so, I mean, some people say, if you want it to have a deterrent effect, and if you want it to be defective, then it must be a reasonable amount of money, that is several thousand euros. But then, if it's so, I mean, you could have the same reasoning with many different rights. So you have the risk that you'll have plenty of claims. And but on the other hand, if you say, well, it's actionable per se, but it's only worth, I don't know, 100 euros, then it's not worth suing for that, of course. So we're a bit at a loss also what to do.
Yeah, but in this case, if you say that is a damage per se, even if the operation has been successful, you are entitled to compensation, right?
Yeah, that's also the problem, exactly. Yeah. An author has argued that it hasn't been followed as such by the Cour de Cassation, but it's quite an interesting idea that if you have not been informed, there is damage which consists in not being prepared to what has appeared, to what has happened. So if you choose this version, then you've got no claim if you were not informed, but everything went well. But then if you were not informed and something went badly, while you were not informed that it could go badly, then you deserve compensation for the fact that you could not prepare yourself for that. But I think it's better solution, but it hasn't been followed by the Cour de Cassation so far.
Professor Wright.
Yeah, I was going to mention the, in terms of what Carlos is talking about, that, I think Italy has done this now too, the same sort of thing, that there is a definite sort of injury in terms of loss of chance in these lack of informed consent cases, in terms of no matter how it turns out or would have turned out or whether you decided or not, you weren't given the chance to make the decision to go ahead. And so it's kind of like the per se battery sort of claim, lack of consent, not quite the same. So there is a definite injury you can point to if you want to recognize it. But apart from that situation, I'm not sure if I agree with the idea that there's a definite injury otherwise in lost chance cases that don't involve the informed consent sort of issue, but involve a failure to diagnose or something like that, because I think probably what goes on in those cases, more like the causation cases, is that, what happens in these cases with proper diagnosis, let's say 70% will survive or have proper treatment, 30% won't. And the only problem is, we just don't know which one of these you are, right? I mean, it's pretty much predetermined at the time that, if you go ahead, you're going to be one or the other. It's just your genetics, it's all sort of things. We just don't know the mechanism well enough. So I think that probably that from that standpoint, it's not really that different from the causation cases.
Yeah, just a couple of comments about the informed consent dilemma. One is comparative, so like what Jean-Sébastien mentioned, with respect to France, we have an Israeli case in the late 90s in which the majority of the court opted for giving damages for the mere injury to autonomy, when the majority thought that there was no causal connection in the sense that she would have decided to undergo the operation if warned. Interestingly, one judge in a minority would have adopted a proportional liability and set it also on 50%. And then another minority judge said that she would give full compensation because she thought that that she would have decided that she would not have done the operation if warned. The other comment is about something that cropped up, I think, from something that Jane said at the beginning. Mentioned is whether there's a double probability here. I don't think that there is, and I know that it's somewhat disputed, but I think that the risk is attached to the person, not to the it's attached to the procedure, but to me it seems more likely to conceive it as attached to the person rather to the time and place that it happened. So if the patient would have undergone it a day after or a month after, unless we have reasons to think that it would be different, you know, standard of clinical standard, so the risk is attached to the person since we know that it happened to them. So if they would have decided to undergo it in another date, mm-hmm. it shouldn't matter. There's no causation. So on this, I'm with Lord Bingham in the dissent on that, that it's a matter of factual causation and not only a matter of attribution. But I think that...
Yeah, there are two... One question is, what would the patient have done? Yeah. And you could assess that on a range of probabilities if you don't have the testimony. The next question is, say they would have delayed and had it the next day, then we have the hypothetical question of what's the chance that it would have eventuated then? In the House of Lords, both questions were done on an all or nothing basis, so not percentages. The first question was allowed to be determined on testimony. And she says more likely than not she would have waited a day. And the second question was then done on the medical evidence of what was the risk inherent in the operation. And unlike Richard's speculation, the majority of the House of Lords said that the evidence was this was not a risk attached to the patient but to the operation. Since it was a 1 in 10,000 chance, more likely than not if she'd delayed a day, it wouldn't have happened to her. It was like lightning striking. It struck her on Monday, but had she delayed, it wouldn't have struck. They were divided on this.
I want to clarify. When I said attached to the patient, I don't mean that there's something in the physiology of the patient that is unique. But any patient that decides to undergo this procedure has 1 to 2% risk of undergoing it. And therefore, if she testifies that eventually I would have undergone it, so the 1 to 2% chance that materialized in that moment that she did should be carried over to the future hypothetical date that she would have undergone it. Yeah, exactly.
That is something that you have to ask. Is it attached to the person's susceptibility, or is it like completely external to her? It's completely external. You go back to the basic rate of side effects in the surgery, so you're back to it being unlikely to struggle if she had a different type.
Professor Keen?
Either way, I would have thought that that risk is not within the scope of the failure to inform liability. That is...
This was Lord Hoffman's dissent.
Okay. So one of the things you get from American law, when you look at what is within the scope of the liability, you ask, you go back to breach and say, what made the conduct objectionable? In this case, it's failing to warn that if you put yourself in this position, you might be struck by lightning. So if you don't warn, the person gets into that position and you're struck by lightning, that seems the very risk that made your conduct careless, because the failure to warn relates to that very consequence.
They warned her about lightning, and then she said, yes, but I'm either taking the risk and hit by lightning, and therefore there's no, definitely, it's not within the scope of risk, and I would say that it's also not factually related. But this case is like, you know, the driving going down and then something falls on you, which I think that you accept that there shouldn't be liability in that that case. So what's the difference from Chester?
I'm sorry to interrupt. If there's a final question, perhaps because we are running out of time and we have to go to have lunch.
Hi, yes, I have Ferranti. A question. Okay, we speak about proportional liability, and of course, one of the cases of proportional liability is the case of the Article 9102 of PETL, Principle of European Tort Law, no? When some tortfeasor are solidarily liable, no? And just one pay for the others. So the first point of departure is that we are in case of negligence or liable, no? And if I understood, you tell that it's not possible a proportional liability when we have strict liability. Now, the question is, do you think that can we speak about proportional liability just in a case, or an hybrid case, when we have a solidarity between a two person, one of them is contract liability, and another is extra contractual liability. I mean, just a case, for example, you speak about before the head of family, and is tort law and strict liability, and the assurance, contract liability. For example, I know that in Spanish law is so different, the moderation of equity of Article 1103, no? But the case is, for example, the assurance of my neighbor pay the damage of me, just add a family who have the infiltration. And the company of assurance take the subrogation in me, but the tribunal apply the moderation of 1103. I mean, this is a transformation because it's different, because the subrogation is on the rights. But this case is just, I think it's a limit case in which we can speak sui generis, proportional liability sui generis, in a case of damage of strict tort liability. What do you think about this?
Well, my point was that I object calling proportional liability cases of apportionment of liability, you know? So since the Roman law and probably before, we have had cases of solidarity liability in Spain, and we have the external relationship and the internal relationship. And the internal relationship, you divide. So if we talk about this proportional liability, well, let's admit it, but we're talking about a different problem. We are not talking about causation problems. So what I say that, of course, you can combine, you can put an insurer, you can do many things, you know. But as long as we keep the terms in confusion, then we are not going to be able, the topic is difficult enough by itself as to shed more confusion over the topic, you know. So in these cases, I wouldn't say if you are solidarily liable, there is no proportional liability. There is an apportionment there, but this has nothing to do with the proportional liability, which the result is that the victim is not fully compensated. Well, depending on the point of view, but it's not going to get 100%. It's going to get compensation according to the probability, you know. And my objection is that now, in my years, when I was a young professor, very few people read English. Since young people, most people read English nowadays, the level of confusion in one doctrine has increased, you know? So we must put back things to work in the sense that, well, people need to progress in their careers, they write very quickly, you know? And of course, and then we have to discuss a lot things that should not be discussed, you know?
Well, let me thank you, thank the speakers once again for their brilliant presentations, and you all for your attention. And let's meet here again at half.